Hello, good afternoon, everyone. So I have the privilege of introducing a man that doesn't really need any introduction. I think a lot of us, especially anybody that attended Wichita State University, had Professor Kahn as a professor. And I was fortunate enough to have him for two classes, political parties and also the presidency. You may have seen him dressed up as John Locke, Alexander Hamilton. I've never seen him dressed up as Plato, though that's also part of his attire. So just some official credentials about Professor Kahn. He has a postdoctorate from Princeton University. He has a PhD from Indiana University. He has an MA from the University of Chicago and a bachelor's from the University of Florida. He has been a delegate to the Democrat National Convention. He's been an intern coordinator for the Republican interns at a Republican National Convention as well. And though he's a Democrat, he's a great man, a great person, and one of the best experts in political science that I've had the fortune of knowing. So without further ado, I want to introduce you to Professor Mel Kahn.
Say that is the most complimentary and a positive introduction, second best one I've ever had. The most complimentary one occurred about 10 years ago when the introducer didn't show up, and so I had to do the job myself. I do want to thank the Pachyderm Club, though, for its open-mindedness, for believing in the idea that competition in politics is good, and being willing to here's somebody who might have a different kind of perspective. One advantage I think I had is that I realized that I am biased, although I try to tone that down somewhat. For example, my favorite program involves a person named Chris, not with MSNBC, but with Fox, because Chris Wallace, I think, is very tough on everybody. And so I think he's the best that I've found in terms of getting information that is straight up. I'm also glad to see former students, I hope I don't miss anybody, but Dan Stockmer, who I recall wrote an outstanding paper, and Rosie Duell, who not only was a former student of mine, but was very cooperative along with her husband when I had students go out into the field and interview precinct committee persons. So it's a real treat to be here today. In fact, I was jotting down the other day going through old calendars, and I think you and the Pachyderm Club have invited me to speak before you twice as many times as my own Democrats. Okay. What I'm going to do today, among other things, is point out the way in which politics has changed in terms of component members who identify with the two major political parties. And I think the best way to illustrate that is to point out that social economic status traditionally accounted for people's identification. Those who were better off financially, who had higher levels of education, tended to identify with the Republican Party. Of the working class, for the most part, and people in general who didn't go beyond high school, identified with the Democratic Party. That was true during the times of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and right on up until things started to change somewhat when Richard Nixon came along. And the thing about Donald Trump is that more effectively than anyone, he has led to much more in the way of realignment than any of his predecessors. And so now we have a situation whereby we have many in the working class who identify with the Republican Party, and many, particularly among women, college-educated women, who used to be in the Republican Party, now identify more with Democrats. And they played a crucial role in this election as far as the House competition was concerned. So that is one change. That I think could be illustrated by a little article that McCall Magazine had some years ago. And it pointed out, for example, that Republicans tended to be more prim and proper and always kept their window shades drawn. But the behavior was so tame, there was no really any reason to. Democrats, on the other hand, never kept their window shades drawn, but they were so, behavior was so outlandish, they really should have. Republicans were usually the people you see coming out of church on Sunday morning. Democrats slept in late, taking care of Saturday night's hangover. Republicans raised Airedales, Dalmatians, and Democrats, on the hand, raised kids, health, and taxes. Republicans had much more fancy fishing equipment. Democrats stayed on the edge of the dock and let the fish come to them. And Republican boys always ended up marrying Republican girls, but they felt they were entitled to a last fling with the Democrat girl. And then most significantly, Republicans, again being more prim and proper, and this is the old days now, tended to sleep in separate beds, sometimes even in separate bedrooms. Democrats, on the other hand, invariably slept in the same bed. And that is why there were more Democrats than there were Republicans. Well, let's talk about what occurred, if I can find my notes here, and I'll give you my view. Bear in mind, I am a biased Democrat. I do try to control this, so anything you think that I misinterpret, feel free to take me on later on. I believe in competition. Okay. One significant factor in this past election was the Women's March shortly after the inauguration of President Trump. And that really fired up a lot of women. In fact, it is purported to be the largest single march that we ever had in American history. And so this was a thing that really got women fired up here, rightly or wrongly. And another important event was the Republicans passed their own health care bill called the American Health Care Act. And they had a big White House reception there. Congressmen came over and were really proud of the fact that they were taking care of the health problem. Well, this shocked a lot of the people who joined the Women's March because they did not think it adequately covered conditions, particularly pre-existing conditions. And this inspired a lot of them to not only get involved, but also to actually become candidates for office themselves. Another significant effect occurred when Mueller was appointed as a special counsel. And on top of that, something that gave the Democrats more inspiration that they could take back the House was when the Supreme Court reached down and declared the remap that had been drawn in Pennsylvania as unconstitutional. And Democrats felt they could pick up 3 or 4 seats as a result of redrawing of the boundaries. And they actually did pick up 3 House seats in the election that were held here. Both parties, though, have had internal problems. Pelosi has had a lot, not only Republicans after her, but also more reform-minded Democrats who thought she'd been in there too long, had old-fashioned ideas, and was sort of making it an old person's club. And it turned out to be fortunate for her because she decided to nip it in the bud and started a revamping of the party structure in Congress, the Democratic Party structure, and elevated a lot of the younger dissidents and was able to bring about the removal of a source of irritation that had bothered the congressional leadership. In the Republican Party, Paul Ryan has always been oriented toward economics. From the very start, did not approve of Trump as a nominee, and throughout his stint as Speaker of the House, has had clashes with President Trump, going all the way up to the final days of the election here. Also, another significant development was that Speaker Ryan announced that he was resigning as Speaker after the term was up, and there were about 37 other Republicans in the House who also resigned, which was like red meat for the Democrats to give them inspiration that they might actually take back the House here. At the same time, though, thanks to Harry Reid, he has been a gift that is just, you know, tremendous as far as the Republican Party is concerned. Because he got rid of the filibuster, the Republicans have been able to use majority rule and be able to load the federal court system, not only the Supreme Court, but also the federal court system up with Republicans. And this is going to have a tremendous impact for years to have. And so as good Republicans, you really ought to send Harry Reid a very nice gift for what he's done to you here. Again, what has happened here is that the traditional lineup has changed. Many working class now have continued something that occurred with Richard Nixon, be able to make some inroads to not only union members, but other people who were not college educated, and at the same time having trouble in terms of the Northeast. It used to be that the South was solidly Democratic regionally, and that Northeast was solidly Republican. There is almost a complete reversal now. Turnout was very significant in this election. Usually there is about 49% of the eligible voters who turn out, 41% to 42% who turn out for a midterm election considered on a national basis. In this particular election, there was an all-time high of 49%, which is a very high number. In fact, sometimes general elections haven't reached that high. And young people turned out in increased numbers. Traditionally, young people have participated, about 90% of them. In this particular election, it was about one-third of them. Also, among the first-time voters, they tended to favor the Democrats. A lot depends on what cohort you come in. For example, people who started voting when Franklin Roosevelt was president managed to stay Democrat the rest of their life. People who came of age when Ronald Reagan was president became permanent Republicans. So a cohort evaluation can tell you a lot about the future. And so the Democrats have that advantage going for the future. But I can tell you as a Democrat, the fact that you've got a formidable advantage to come for years to come, everybody wishes her well, but Ruth Ginsburg, I think, is about 84 years old. She is hospitalized because of the fall, and I don't think that Trump is going to replace her with a Democrat. Okay. Women candidates. About 450 women filed for legislative and executive positions throughout the states, and there are three times as many Democratic women running as Republican women. In fact, in Arizona, we even had a case where you had two women running against each other for the Arizona Senate, and we're going to find more of that in times to come. Another factor that's come back is we tend to think of a lot of people as really independents. Well, a lot of people who call themselves independents are really leaners and sort of become a false symbol, because civic groups, for example, claim you ought to be independent, not belong to a party, and so forth. But the truth of the matter is still about 90% of the people are identified with a political party. Now, when you scratch the surface among so-called independents, you come to something interesting. I'm an independent. I always vote for the best person. Oh, yeah? Well, tell me, who did you vote for in the last four elections? Well, I told you, I'm an independent. I voted for the best person. Well, who was that best person? Well, let's see. I voted for Hillary, Kerry, Obama, and Obama. I'm independent. I always vote for the best person. Well, that's one of the big myths in American politics that we ought to be aware of here. Another unusual thing happened in this election. Usually, somewhere around 40 to 45% say the most important factor in their voting midterm is your position on the president, whether you want to reaffirm your support for the president or you want to oppose him. In this particular election, two-thirds of the public voted either for or against President Trump. So that is very unique in that regard. He is a very significant factor regarding both sides here. The Democrats, during the years of the traditional years that I talked about, usually had about an 18% advantage in terms of party identification. That has been reduced to 6% advantage now in party identification. Well, then, why is it the Republicans win so many races? Well, the fact is that the people who vote tend to see more meaning in an election. And they're usually the people who are more educated in a formal sense. And so I'm not saying that means that Republicans are smarter than Democrats, although you can find evidence on that. But the fact is that Republicans do a much better job of turning out their people. And so that's what evens it out to a large degree, so that we have a lot of competitive races now. In fact, it was just amazing as you look at the different outcomes throughout the nation, how many were decided, races were decided by just 1 or 2 percentage points here. We also had an ethics factor at work in this election, or a non-ethics factor. And it's a bipartisan type of thing. You have 2 congressmen who have both been indicted who managed to win re-election. And you also had a man who, while he was able to get a hung jury in terms of Menendez in New Jersey, was still reelected, aside from the fact that it looks like he was very blatantly on the take from his ambassador by taking hundreds of thousands of different favors of travel trips and watch Rolex watches and things like that. And I think that that is something that all of us could agree should not occur, and that we ought to punish those people who commit unethical practices while supposedly serving the public here. Blacks were significant in this election, but their percentage voting Democratic has been reduced. It used to be that it was about 80 to 85% in favor of Democrats. In this election, interviews seem to indicate that 21% of blacks voted for Republican candidates. So that shows some inroads on the part of the Republican Party here. The referenda, Carl took part of my speech by pointing out that the tax factors in generally went down, but it was very interesting that in Florida, 67% of the people favored an amendment that gives felons the right to vote in elections. You don't have to individually go and have an interview with the governor. And since a lot of felons tend to be Democrats, that will probably help the Democrats in future elections here. Just part of reality here. Well, let's sort of summarize the midterms. Again, the whole culture of what we have now, and not only the Supreme Court, but the federal court system, where most cases are decided, is just a continuing gift that will continue giving for many, many years, courtesy of the aforementioned Senator Harry Reid. He took an immediate advantage, and he and his party are going to suffer for many, many years to come. Getting back to this particular election, though, the advantage of the Republicans holding on to the Senate, in fact, expanding their hold on the Senate, I used to think that, well, next time there'll be more Republican seats at risk. And I took a look at that, and I was shocked, because most of the seats at risk are in the South or in places like Maine and Colorado, where you have outstanding senators who, as far as being effective campaigners go, Cory Gardner in Colorado, and I'm having a scene moment now on the Maine senator.
Susan Collins.
Thank you. And they are pretty sure about, I think, to be reelected. So there will not be a Republican disadvantage in the next election as there was a Republican disadvantage, as there was a disadvantage for the Democrats in this particular election. The Democrats tend to be much more practical than 4 years ago. For example, instead of, and I heard the analogy used, that you want to go after the cake. And the cake is found, as far as Democrats are concerned, in the northern industrial states, like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And what happened was Hillary didn't even go to Wisconsin in the last election. She put a lot of money and a lot of time into trying to run up a big electoral college margin in Arizona and Texas. And it was a waste of time and money. The Democrats didn't do this at this time. And so this can help them very much in the next election by the fact that they took it. In fact, they were particularly pragmatic in the state of Michigan. In fact, the winning candidate for governor used the slogan, "Let's fix the damn roads." You know, nothing ideological or anything. The things that an issue that people could identify with. Pelosi became very practical, and she was able to mute her extremes. She encouraged young people who had run against her to continue talking about getting rid of her and all, because it would help them, you know, in their own races. But at the same time, she was a very much activated person in terms of giving recognition to these younger new candidates here, and was able to keep her party together, which had threatened to fly apart here. In general, though, I think that the Trump people can be criticized in terms of spending too much time on the attack and too much time on immigration and not bragging about the economy enough. It was mentioned, but usually people don't appreciate that which they have. They usually raise hell about what they don't have. And I think it would have been a lot smarter if there had been more time spent by Trump, who I would say is a very, very effective communicator in terms of the economy and the jobs that he's created. And I think that he really missed the boat on that. Republicans, though, while the Democrats were highly motivated, I think used the Kavanaugh hearings very smartly to make the Democrats look over the top in terms of going after Kavanaugh. The idea of going after a person in terms of what he allegedly did in high school, I think struck a lot of people as, well, I don't know, anybody here who ever did anything foolish in high school? Okay. And one thing that helped, though, I think there was a real trend going for Republicans as well as the of Kavanaugh hearings, and I think it brought their motivation up to the level of the Democrats. But Pittsburgh synagogue tragedy, I think, focused things again in terms of just sort of stopping the emphasis on the Kavanaugh thing. And I think, as Trump pointed out in one of his speeches, did a stop to the surge that was occurring at the end. One thing I want to emphasize, though, midterms are not a good predictor for the following presidential election. Midterms are not a good predictor for the following presidential re-election. For example, George Bush had a bad midterm. It didn't stop him from being re-elected. Bill Clinton and Obama. So we ought to keep that in mind, that this is not a death knell for the Republican Party. In fact, I would say that the Republicans have at least an even chance of taking the next presidential election. Of getting the most votes? No. But it doesn't do Democrats any real good to win by 2 million votes in California as opposed to Republicans winning by 1% in Ohio, let us say. So the Republicans are able to run a very much more strategic centered campaign than the Democrats are. And I would say, from the point of enlightened self-interest, you would be very smart to not support efforts to abandon the Electoral College. It's just a reality in terms of our federal system that the founding fathers devised here. Let's take a look at the cloudy crystal ball now. But I would like to point out, though, that I can remember I put together some predictions that were made by eminent scholars as well as journalists. And here's some of the things I came up with. For example, no way Harry Truman can beat Thomas Dewey. It's impossible that a young playboy Catholic is actually going to win the presidency. Richard Nixon is now a two-time loser after getting defeated in California and raising hell with the media that they won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. He's finished. It's impossible for Reagan, after having the recession that occurred, to think in terms of any realistic chance of having a second term. George Herbert Walker Bush, in terms of what he accomplished in Iraq, is a cinch to beat the hick governor from Arkansas. And finally, There is no way that an entertainer like Donald Trump is going to beat a person like Hillary Clinton. So keep in mind that put several grains of salt on these predictions that come out. Well, looking ahead with my cloudy crystal ball, I see real dogfights coming between the Democrats and the Republicans, as well as with the Trump administration. I think there are going to be dogfights about the limitations that are going to be put up on the Mueller report, if it does get reported or not. We'll see what happens here. It's interesting to see people change their minds. I remember a couple years ago, Lindsey Graham said there's going to be hell to pay if they do anything to interfere with Trump's investigation. I think you see that he has switched on that here. The investigations, the new head of the House Judiciary Committee is impeachment minded. Anybody know his name?
Jerry Nadler.
Right, good. And 73% of the Democratic members of the House are in favor of impeachment. Well, you see what impeachment did to Bill Clinton. In fact, I think so far there hasn't been any evidence connecting the president directly to selling out America, any of the things he's been accused of. I don't know if Mueller has anything or not, but the point is Pelosi, being a pragmatic politician, is very much opposed to that. And she's going to do what she can to put the screws to Nadler to not go forward with that, because it'll be a net loss for the Democrats if they do that. But you can expect a lot of investigations by the Democrats into various aspects of the Trump administration. And the Trump people aren't about to readily give up the tax returns that the Democrats want. I also have a wish list. Sometimes enlightened leaders will get together and do things for the good of the American people, and it can make both the Democrats and Republicans look good. For example, prescription rates, and for any of you are my age cohort, you support the pharmaceutical industry to a large extent, and the prices are darn high. It costs a lot more to buy stuff manufactured in America than it does in Canada, for example. And Trump is on record as saying he wants to do something about it, and I think the Democrats are too. It would be great if they could get together and somehow allow reasonable profits, but not allow sky-high things, particularly where you have one pharmaceutical house having a monopoly on a product that is urgently needed for the health of people. Trump is also interested in criminal justice reform. There is just ridiculous sentences handed out many times to minority groups in terms of crack cocaine and so forth and so on. And I think it would be good if both the Democrats and the Trump administration and Republicans in the Senate could get together on that. And also, there is a great need for our internal structural reform. We have bridges that are actually in danger of falling down. We have roads that are inadequate. It would be a great job booster. I think if we could consider it in terms of being an investment, of helping industry grow, of helping jobs created, it could be a win-win situation. But that is a wish list. Whether it's going to come true or not, I'm not betting on it, but I am hoping. So I really enjoyed being here today, and if any of you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
We're going to have to do a little bit of a change here in terms of, are you going to be able to
take
the mic?
Yeah.
Okay. Alta will have the, or who's got the microphone? Okay, we're going to have a person speak up. But before we do this, one of the disadvantages of having me stand in for John Stevens, I wish he'd come back and do this, but I should have asked, are there any other elected officials here? And we've got State Representative-elect Steve Owens in the back. We've got City Council Member James Clendenin. Do we have any other elected officials?
Did you turn off the microphone?
Yes.
Carl, do you want me to work the microphone?
I'm going to turn that up.
We have to get the microphone.
No problem.
Who do we have for questions?
All right. Turn it on.
In 2020, we will be conducting a new census. Our president would like to have, and many others also, the question, are you an American citizen? Are you a U.S. citizen on the questionnaire? If that is approved and allowed to be on the questionnaire, how do you feel the result, rather accurate or inaccurate, of the census because of that question will affect future elections?
Well, that's a good question. My Democratic bias comes out. I think what it's going to do is a lot of people who are concerned about being turned over for outstanding warrants, whatever it might be, and that's more prevalent among Democrats than Republicans, I think will not participate. And so that will make some inaccuracy as far as the census goes. If the question is on there, I think it will reduce the amount of Democrats voting in the future.
I've noticed in a couple of the races that the 2016 group of candidates for the Republican presidential nomination, that they had a very close race, Scott Walker, Ted Cruz. Do you think that's a factor of people being resentful of them coming off of a bigger ticket?
I'm sorry, can you please repeat the last part louder?
Do you think there was a little bit of resentment by the constituents that they're like Ted Cruz is trying not to get him back in, and Scott Walker being a close election because they ran for president instead of sticking to their office that they held?
I don't believe so, because you want to encourage people to be willing to run for president. It's a very arduous task. And I don't think that it should bar them from if after failing they go back, because I think they have a lot to offer the public, whether you agree with them or not, in terms of their experience. So I'm all for permitting people to run for their office if they fail to get the presidency. In fact, John Quincy Adams, after he was president, actually went back and became a congressman and became an ardent advocate for civil rights, and was a very inspirational force after being shunted aside and criticized as a member of Congress. And so a lot of times it can add a lot. Newt Gingrich ran for president, yet I regard him as an outstanding person to have as a politically involved. And I would welcome him becoming a member of Congress if he wanted to. I mean, he makes for the type of competition that Democrats need. He's a very bright guy.
Okay, right over here.
Yes.
Yeah, I heard that Mr. Bloomberg gave over $80 million to Democratic candidates at his last election. And do you think he could unify the Democrats? Because it looks like he wants to run for president.
I think he probably could, that doesn't necessarily mean that he would win, because he's been a Republican in the past too, and a lot of people just don't like persons who go back and forth. And let's face it takes money in order to run successful campaigns. That's one of the things that Pelosi did this time, and she not only accepted Bloomberg's money, but George Soros also was very welcome. And traditionally, Republicans have done a better job of raising money than Democrats have. This time, though, there was a real problem in the Republican Party. The fundraising arm of the Republican National Committee had conflict many times with the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. And there was a lot of infighting that went on there. You even had a situation where Kevin Yoder, for example, money was withdrawn from him by the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. And then later, Trump actually put in an appearance in Kansas City to try to help Yoder out. So these kind of things can hurt when you have battles over the allocation of money. Dan?
Yeah, I just want to thank you for coming back and speaking. I think you were probably one of the first speakers the club ever had back in the 80s, and I always admired your insight. And so I have a couple questions.
Sure.
On the fact that the Hispanic vote, number one, there's a good possibility there that Hispanics could come over on the Republican side, which would make a huge difference in the future. What's your perspective on that? And number two, it's possible that we're going to be surrounded within the next 5 years by states that have legalized marijuana or at least medical marijuana. Do you see that happening in the state of Kansas?
I don't know. I don't know. In the Hispanic, though, it's interesting. As people in the lower income category, many of them do favor government redistribution policies. On the other hand, though, like with blacks, you have a growing Hispanic middle class, and I think they identify more in terms of economics with Republicans. And also, while the abortion issue wasn't as prominent in this election as it has been in the past, there are Hispanics, particularly among older, more traditional Hispanics, who feel very strongly on the abortion question. And to religious Hispanics who identify strongly with their faith, I think that makes the Republican Party more appealing.
From your perspective, do you see a bias in the news media that the Republican Party sees? And also, do you think the media's attitude makes it more difficult for Republican candidates?
Yes, yes, but I see a bias, for example, on Fox, except I think the best person by far of any of the people at programs is Chris Wallace, who's on Fox on Sundays. And yes, there is. And I think Trump has used that to advantage. Now, I think when he goes after the media as being disloyal to America and all, to me, that's somewhat over the top. Does the media make mistakes? Does the media have bias? Yes. Now, Trump has used that to good advantage. Ronald Reagan used the hostility of Sam Donaldson to him to great advantage. For example, I still remember vivid scenes when Reagan was mounting his helicopter. Donaldson would start asking tough questions, and by some prearranged signal, the rotors would begin to rev up and drown out. And here, Donaldson was just screaming at Reagan, and Reagan was his jovial self just handling it. So I think you can't either by being a nice guy like Reagan was, or going hard after them as Trump has, although I think in some places with more moderate Republicans, he probably had negative results on that. But yes, I think there is media bias. I think radio, for example, tends to be biased toward conservatives. I would not accuse CNN or MSNBC of being objective. Or Fox.
Would you offer your opinion and your preference of whether the Electoral College should be replaced with popular vote, one? And then a second question, if I may, convention of states, what do you think about it?
I'll take the second one first. I don't think that we get very far. The requirements of the convention, I think right off the bat, they'd probably beat each other's throats over issues like gun control and abortion. So I don't think it would work out where you could come to any agreement. It would just be very difficult. As a Democrat, in terms of my biases, I would like to see the Electoral College abolished because Democrats are very strong in the big states like California, particularly here. On the other hand, in terms of providing some sort of a balance, we are not a one-person, one-vote country. We require, 60% to cut off debate now in the Senate. If you want to have an amendment like the Equal Rights Amendment, you have to get two-thirds of each chamber to agree to the resolution. And surprisingly, this did occur once under the Birch proposal for abolishing the Electoral College. And then you have to get three-fourths of the states to ratify the amendment. And then on top of that, in Illinois, they played some interesting games. One year, one of the chambers would vote for the amendment, and the other chamber would vote against it. And so a legislator going up for re-election can have an old copy of the previous session and have it circled and blown up. Look, I voted for the amendment. And avoid pointing out that the current session, he voted against it. Most people don't follow that closely. So it's very difficult to amend it. And I think, though, that states are important. States should have representation. And also, I think that fraud would be maximized. Under the present system, a state can commit fraud, but only if affect the outcome in that state. Now, in the 2000 election, you had a situation where the co-campaign manager for President Bush, for candidate Bush, was also the election commissioner. And she called decisions in a biased way, just like Mayor Daley did in Chicago. But they could only affect the outcome in their particular state if it was close in terms of the electoral votes. On the other hand, if you had a popular vote, and let's say nationwide, the Republicans were 600,000 votes ahead, and Mayor Daley could at 5 a.m. in the morning come in with 900,000 votes in favor of the Democratic candidate and would affect the whole election. And what would happen here is while the emphasis is now put on the two-party states, where you have competition in anywhere from 8 to 12 states that are pretty evenly divided, what we would do is switch the emphasis to the one-party states, where there is no good check on the other side, where one party controls the election machinery and just run up the totals, and they could just go wild. And so the Electoral College is a check on that. As it, wearing my Democratic hat, yes, because the Democrats are likely to get more votes. In terms of being a political scientist, I think they would just open the gates for too much fraud, since you could just run rampant in the one-party states. So I am against changing the Electoral College.
What's your opinion on the reasons for the outcome on the Kansas governor's race?
On the regions what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
That's okay. The reasons for the outcome of the Kansas governor's race.
Reasons for the outcome of the governor's race.
Yes. Why the Democrats won.
Why the Democrats won the governor's race.
Let's go along with Kelly.
I don't quite see the connection. I just said I'm informed on this. What was the allegation of what the region
said? Why did Laura Kelly beat Kobach?
Why did Whitey Kelly beat Kobach?
I think because Kobach, I think, is a foolish politician with a high IQ. I think the fact that he was, Johnny one note in terms of just, but being identified largely in the mind of the public with fraud, I don't think he was considered to be a good all-around candidate. I mean, when you realize that every single Republican governor, except for Brownback, endorsed him, I mean, that is an unusual thing. And then a person of the stature of Nancy Kassebaum, I think those are very important factors in why he was defeated here.
Final question.
Let me just say, I think had Collier been the nominee, he would have won.
Final question for you, Mel. It's a two-parter. It's going to rely on your crystal ball. You're going to have to call it out. When next year, when the first presidential debate leading up to the Iowa caucus occurs, how many Democrat candidates will be out on that stage, and will Hillary be one of them?
I hope not. I believe it's going to probably be, right now I would say there are probably about 25 people who are planning, but when it comes to raising the money, but on the other hand, it's a good publicity, and if you have a business that relies upon, consumerism, it's good free advertising.
Professor Mel Kahn, thank you.